his eyes are going to jump right out of his head. He'll be real glad to see us, won't he? Swan asked. Sure will. Damn it. I wish they'd come on and get us out of here. When are they coming? Soon, Mama. That kid's aged 10 years since the blast, Josh thought. I had a dream about Blakeman, Darlene said. You and me were walking, and I could see the old house right in front of us across the field. And the sun was shining so bright. Oh, it was such a pretty day. And I looked over the field and saw my daddy standing on the porch, and he was waving for me to come on across. He didn't hate me anymore. And all of a sudden, my mama came out of the house, and she was standing on the porch beside him. And they were holding hands, and she called, Darlene, Darlene. We're waiting for you, child. Come on home now. She was silent, just the wet sound of her breathing. We started across the field, but Mama said, No, honey, just you, not the little girl, just you. But I didn't want to go across without my angel, and I was afraid, and Mama said, The little girl's got to go on a long, long way. Oh, I wanted to cross that field. I wanted to, but I couldn't. She found Swan's hand. I want to go home, honey. It's all right, Swan whispered, and she smoothed back the sweat-damped remnants of her mother's hair. I love you, Mama. I love you so much. Oh, I messed things up. A sob caught in Darlene's throat. I messed up everything I ever touched. Oh, God. Who's going to watch out for my angel? I'm afraid. I'm so afraid. She began to sob brokenly, and Swan cradled her head and whispered, Shh, Mama, I'm here. I'm right here. Josh crawled away from them. He found his corner and curled up in it, trying to escape. He didn't know how much time had passed, maybe hours, when he heard a noise near him. He sat up. Mister? Swan's voice was weak and wounded. I think my mama's gone home. She broke then and began to cry and moan at the same time. Josh folded his arms around her, and she clung to his neck and cried. He could feel the child's heart beating, and he wanted to scream and rage. And if any of the prideful fools who had pushed those buttons were anywhere within reach, he could have snapped their necks like matchsticks. Thinking about how many millions might be lying dead out there warped Josh's mind, like trying to figure out how big the universe was or how many billions of stars winked in the skies. But right now there was just this little girl sobbing in his arms, and she could never see the world in the same way as before. No matter what happened to them, she would forever be marked by this moment, and Josh knew he would as well. Because it was one thing to know that there might be millions of faceless dead out there. It was something else again to know that a woman who used to breathe and talk and whose name was Darlene was lying dead in the dirt less than 10 feet away. And he would have to bury her in that same dirt, have to use the pickaxe and the broken shovel and dig the grave on his knees, have to bury her deep so they wouldn't crawl over her in the dark. He felt the child's tears on his shoulder, and when he reached up to touch her hair, his fingers found blisters and burned stubble. And he prayed to God in that moment that, if they were going to die, the child would pass away before him so she wouldn't be alone with the dead. Swan cried herself out. She gave a last whimper and leaned limply against Josh's shoulder. Swan, he said, I want you to sit here and not move for a while. Will you do like I say? She made no response, then finally she nodded. Josh set her aside, got the pickaxe and shovel. He decided to dig the hole as far away as possible from the corner where Swan lay, and he started scooping away a mess of corn stalks, broken glass, and splintered wood. His right hand brushed something metal buried in the loose dirt, and at first he thought it was another can he could add to the others. But this one was different. It was a slim cylinder. He picked it up in both hands and ran his fingers over it. Not a can, he realized. Not a can, my God, oh Jesus. It was a flashlight, and it held enough weight to suggest that there were batteries inside. He found the off-on switch with his thumb, but he dared not press it yet, not until he'd closed his eyes and whispered, please, please, let it still work, please. He took a deep breath and pressed the little switch. There was no change, no sensation of light against his closed eyelids. Josh opened his eyes and looked at the darkness. The flashlight was useless. He thought he would burst out laughing for a second, but then his face contorted with anger and he shouted, "Damn it to hell!" He reared his arm back to fling the flashlight to pieces against the wall, and as the flashlight jiggled an instant before he let it fly, a weak yellow ray speared from its bulb. But to Josh, it looked like the mightiest, most powerful light in all of creation. It all but dazzled him blind, and then it flickered and went out again. He jiggled it furiously. The light played an impish game, coming on and going off again and again. And then Josh reached two fingers through the cracked plastic lens to the tiny bulb itself. Carefully, his fingers trembling, he gave the bulb a gentle clockwise turn. And this time the light stayed. A dim, murky light, yes, but light. Josh lowered his head and wept. Chapter 22. Night caught them on Communipaw Avenue in the ruins of Jersey City, just east of Newark Bay. They found a bonfire of debris burning within the roofless hulk of a building, and it was there that Sister decided they should rest. The building's walls deflected the freezing wind, and there was enough flammable material around to keep the fire burning until morning. They huddled close around the bonfire, because standing only 6 feet away was like being in a meat locker. Beth Phelps held her palms toward the fire.
God, it's so cold. Why is it so cold? It's still July.
I'm no scientist, Artie ventured, sitting between her and the Spanish woman. But I guess the blasts threw so much dust and junk into the air that it's done something to the atmosphere, screwed up the sun's rays or something.
I've never been so cold before.
Her teeth chattered.
I just can't get warm.
Summer's over, Sister said as she rummaged through the contents of her bag. I don't think it's going to be summer again for a long time. She brought out the ham slices, the last of the soggy bread, and the two cans of anchovies. Also, in the water-shrunken bag were several items that Sister had found today. A small aluminum pot with a black rubber-coated handle, a little knife with a serrated blade, a jar of Folgers freeze-dried coffee, and a single thick garden glove with two fingers burned away. Stuffed into the bottom of the bag was the glass ring, which Sister had neither looked at nor disturbed since they'd come out of the tunnel. She wanted to save looking at it and holding the treasure for later, like a gift she would give herself at the end of the day. None of them had spoken again about the Holland Tunnel. It seemed more like a hideous dream, something they wanted to forget. But Sister felt stronger now. They had made it through the tunnel. They could make it through another night and another day.
Take some bread, she told them. Here, go easy on the ham.
She chewed on a soggy hunk of bread and watched the Spanish woman eat.
Do you have a name?
Sister asked. The Spanish woman looked at her incuriously. a name. Sister made the motion of writing in the air. What's your name? The Spanish woman busied herself with tearing a slice of ham into small bite-sized pieces.
Maybe she's crazy, Artie said. You know, maybe losing her kid like that made her crazy. Think that could be?
Maybe, Sister agreed, and she got the ashy-tasting bread down her throat.
I guess she's Puerto Rican, Beth offered. I almost took Spanish in college, but I wound up taking a music appreciation course instead.
What do you...
Artie stopped himself. He smiled wanly, and slowly the smile faded.
What did you do for a living, Beth?
I'm a secretary for the Holmhauser Plumbing Supply Company on West 11th, third floor corner office, the Broward Building. I'm Mr. Alden's secretary. He's the vice president. He was the vice president.
She hesitated, trying to remember.
Mr. Alden had a headache, and he asked me to go across the street to the drugstore to get him a bottle of Excedrin. I remember I was standing on the corner of 11th and 5th waiting for the light to change. This nice-looking guy asked me if I knew where some sushi restaurant was, but I said I didn't know. And the light changed, and everybody started across the street. But I wanted to keep talking to that guy because he was really cute and, well, I don't really get to meet a lot of guys I'd like to go out with. We were about halfway across and he looks at me and smiles and says, "My name's Keith. What's yours?" Beth smiled sadly and shook her head. I never got to answer him. I remember a loud roaring sound. I had a feeling that a wave of heat just knocked me off my feet. Then I think somebody grabbed my hand and told me to run. I did. I ran like hell. And I could hear people screaming, and I think I was screaming too. All I remember after that is hearing somebody say, "She's still alive." I got mad. I thought, of course I'm still alive. Why wouldn't I still be alive? I opened my eyes, and Mr. Kaplan and Jack were bending over me.
Beth's gaze focused on Sister.
We're not the only ones who made it, are we? I mean, it's not just us alone, is it? I doubt it. The ones who could make it out have probably already moved west or north or south, Sister said. There's sure as hell no reason to go east. My God.
Beth drew in a sharp breath.
My mom and dad, my little sister, they live in Pittsburgh. You don't think Pittsburgh is like this, do you? I mean, Pittsburgh could be okay, right?
She grinned crookedly, but her eyes were wild.
What's to bomb in Pittsburgh, right?
Right, she agreed, and she concentrated on opening one of the anchovy cans with its little key. She knew the salty taste of the things might make them more thirsty, but food was food.
Anybody want one of these?
She scooped a fillet up on her finger and put it in her mouth. The fishy taste almost made her tongue curl, but she got the thing down, figuring fish had iodine or something that would be good for her. Both Artie and Beth took an anchovy, but the Spanish woman turned her head away. They finished the bread. Sister put the remaining slices of ham back in her bag, then poured the oil from the anchovy can onto the ground and returned the can to the bag as well. The ham and fish might carry them a couple of days more if rationed properly. What they had to do tomorrow was find something to drink. They sat huddled around the bonfire as the wind shrieked beyond the building's walls. Every so often, an errant blast got inside the building and swept up cinders like comets before it spun itself out. There was only the noise of the wind and the fanning flames, and Sister stared into the seething orange heart of the bonfire.
Sister, she looked toward Artie, would you mind if I held it?
He asked hopefully. She knew what he meant. Neither of them had held it since that day in the ruins of the Steuben glass shop. Sister reached down into her bag, pushed aside the other junk, and put her hand around the object wrapped in a scorched striped shirt. She brought it up and peeled the still wet shirt away. Instantly,
The glass circle with its five spires and its embedded jewels burst into brilliance, absorbing the bonfire's light. The thing shone like a fireball, perhaps even brighter than before. It pulsed with her heartbeat, as if her own life force powered it, and the threads of gold, platinum, and silver sizzled with light.
Oh,
Beth breathed. The gemstone lights were reflected in her eyes.
Oh, what is that? I've never seen anything like that in my life.
Sister found it, Artie replied. His voice was reverent, his attention riveted to the glass ring. He tentatively held out both hands.
May I? Please?
Sister gave it to him. When Artie had it, the pulsations of the gemstones shifted speed and rhythm, picking up Artie's heartbeat. He shook his head with wonder, his eyes full of rainbow colors.
Holding this makes me feel good, he said. It makes me feel like all the beauty in the world isn't dead yet.
He ran his fingers over the glass spires and circled his forefinger over an emerald the size of a large almond.
So green, he whispered. So green.
He smelled the clean, fresh aroma of a pine woods. He was holding a sandwich in his hands, pastrami on rye with hot, spicy mustard, just the way he liked it. Startled, he looked up and saw around himself a vision of green forest and emerald meadowland. Beside him was a cooler with a bottle of wine in it, and a paper cup full of wine sat close at hand. He was sitting on a green-striped tablecloth. A wicker picnic basket was open in front of him, displaying a bounty of food.
I'm dreaming, he thought. My God, I'm dreaming with my eyes open.
But then he saw his hands, blistered and burned. He was still wearing the fur coat and his red pajamas. The sturdy black wingtips were still on his feet, but he felt no pain, and the sunshine was bright and warm, and a silken breeze stirred through the pine forest. He heard a car door slam. Parked about 30 feet away was a red T-bird. A tall, smiling young woman with curly brown hair was walking toward him, carrying a transistor radio that was playing Smoke Gets in Your Eyes.
We couldn't have asked for a better day, could we?
The young woman asked, swinging the radio at her side.
No, Artie replied, stunned. I guess not.
He had never smelled air so fresh and clean before, and that T-bird, my God, he thought. The T-bird had a foxtail hanging on the antenna. He remembered that set of wheels now. It was the finest, fastest car he'd ever owned, and... Wait a minute, he thought as the young woman approached.
Hold the phone. What the hell is... Drink your wine, the woman offered. Aren't you thirsty? Yeah, I am thirsty.
He picked up the cup and drank the wine in three swallows. His throat had been burning with thirst. He held the cup out for more and downed that one just as fast, and then Artie looked into the woman's soft blue eyes, saw the oval shape of her face, and realized who she was.
But she couldn't be. She was 19 years old, and here they were back on their picnic on the afternoon he had asked her to marry him. "You're staring, Artie," she said teasingly. "I'm sorry, it's just... I mean, you're young again, and I'm sitting here like a French fry in red pajamas. I mean, it's not right."
She frowned as if she couldn't fathom what he was talking about.
"You're silly," she decided. "Don't you like your sandwich?" "Sure, sure I do."
He bit into it, expecting it to dissolve like a mirage between his teeth. But he had a mouthful of pastrami. And if this was a dream, it was the best damned dream sandwich he had ever eaten. He poured himself a third cup of wine and guzzled it merrily. The sweet, clean scent of the pine woods filled the air, and Artie breathed deeply. He stared out at the green woods and the meadow, and he thought, "My God, it's good to be alive." You all right?
Huh? The voice had startled him. He blinked and was looking at Sister's blistered face. The glass ring was still between his hands.
I asked you if you're all right, she said. You've been looking into that thing for about half a minute, just sitting there staring.
Oh. Artie saw the bonfire, the faces of Beth and the Spanish woman, the ruined walls of the building.
I don't know where I went, he thought, but I'm back now.
He imagined that he could taste pastrami, spicy mustard, and wine lingering in his mouth. He even felt just a bit lightheaded, as if he'd drunk too much too fast. But his stomach felt full now, and he wasn't thirsty anymore.
Yeah, I'm all right.
He let his fingers play along the glass ring for a moment longer, and then he handed it back to Sister.
Thank you, he said.
She took it. For an instant, she thought she smelled, what was it, liquor? But then the faint odor was gone. Artie Wisco leaned back and belched.
Can I hold that? Beth asked her. I'll be careful with it.
She took it from Sister as the Spanish woman admired it over her shoulder.
It reminds me of something, something I've seen, she said. I can't think of what, though.
She peered through the glass at the sparkle of topaz and diamonds.
Oh, Lord, do you know what this must be worth?
Sister shrugged.
I guess it would have been worth some money a few days ago. Now, I'm not so sure. Maybe it's worth some cans of food and a can opener. Maybe a pack of matches. At the most, a jug of clean water.
Water, Beth thought. It had been over 24 hours since she'd had a drink of the ginger ale. Her mouth felt like a dry field. A drink of water, just a sip, would be so wonderful. Her fingers suddenly submerged into the glass. Except it wasn't glass anymore. It was a stream of water running over multicolored stones. She pulled her hand away, and drops of water fell like diamonds from the tips of her fingers back into the flowing stream. She sensed Sister watching her, but she also felt distanced from the other woman, distanced from the wreckage of the city around them. She felt Sister's presence, but it was as if the woman was in another room of a magic mansion to which Beth had just found the front door key. The cool stream of water made an inviting, chuckling sound as it passed over the colored stones. There can't be water running right across my lap, Beth thought, and for an instant the stream wavered and started to fade, a thing of mist burned off by the stark sun of reason.
No, she wished, not yet.
The water continued flowing right under her hands, moving from beyond to beyond. Beth put her hand into it again.
So cool. So cool.
She caught some of the water in her palm and brought it to her mouth. It tasted better than any glass of Perrier she'd ever had. Again she drank from it, and then she lowered her head to the stream and drank as the water rushed around her cheek like a lingering kiss. Sister thought Beth Phelps had gone into some kind of trance. She'd watched Beth's eyes suddenly glaze over. Like Artie, Beth hadn't moved for over 30 seconds.
Hey, Sister said.
She reached out and poked Beth.
Hey, what's wrong with you?
Beth looked up. Her eyes cleared.
What? Nothing. I think it's time we got some rest.
Sister started to take the glass circle back, but the Spanish woman abruptly grabbed it and scrambled away, sinking down amid the broken stones and clasping it to her body. Both Sister and Beth stood up, and Beth thought she felt her stomach slosh. Sister walked to the Spanish woman, who was sobbing with her head bent over. Sister knelt beside her and said gently,
"Come on. Let me have that back, okay?"
"Mi niña me perdona,"
the woman sobbed.
"Madre de Dios, mi niña me perdona."
What's she saying? Beth asked, standing behind Sister. I don't know. Sister put her hand around the glass ring and slowly pulled it toward her. The Spanish woman held on to it, shaking her head back and forth.
Come on, Sister urged. Let me have it.
My child forgives me, the Spanish woman suddenly said. Her eyes were wide and full of tears. Mother of God! I saw my child's face in this, and she said she forgives me. I'm free, Mother of God, I'm free.
Sister was stunned.
I didn't think you knew English.
Now it was the Spanish woman's turn to blink dazedly.
What? What's your name? How come you haven't spoken English before this? My name is Julia. Julia Castillo. English? I don't know what you mean. Either I'm crazy or she is, Sister said. Come on, let me have this.
She pulled the ring away, and Julia Castillo let it go.
Okay, now, how come you haven't spoken English before now, Julia? No comprendo, she replied. Good morning, good day. I am happy to see you, sir. Thank you.
She shrugged and motioned vaguely southward.
Matanzas, she said. Cuba.
Sister turned her head toward Beth, who had stepped back a couple of paces and had a weird expression on her face.
Who's crazy, Beth, Julia or me? Does this lady know English or not?
Beth said,
She was speaking in Spanish. She never said one word of English. Did you understand what she said? Hell yes, I understood her. Every damned word, didn't...
She stopped speaking. Her hand holding the glass ring was tingling. Beyond the bonfire, Artie suddenly sat up and hiccuped.
Hey, he said in a slightly slurred voice. Where's the party?
Sister held the glass circle out toward Julia Castillo again. The Spanish woman touched it hesitantly.
What did you say about Cuba? Sister asked. I'm from Matanzas in Cuba,
Julia replied in perfect English. Her eyes were large and puzzled.
My family came over in a fishing boat. My father could speak a little English, and we came north to work in a shirt factory. How do you know my language?
Sister looked at Beth.
What do you hear, Spanish or English?
Spanish. Isn't that what you heard?
No.
She pulled the ring out of Julia's grasp.
Now say something. Say anything.
Julia shook her head.
Lo siento, no comprendo.
Sister stared at Julia for a moment, and then she slowly lifted the ring closer to her face to peer into its depths. Her hand was trembling, and what felt like little jolts of energy coursed through her forearm to her elbow.
It's this, Sister said, this glass thing. I don't know why or how, but this thing lets me understand her, and she can understand me, too. I heard her speak English, Beth, and I think she heard me speak Spanish.
That's crazy, Beth said, but she thought of the cool stream that had flowed across her lap, and her throat was no longer parched.
I mean, it's just glass and jewels, isn't it? Here, Sister offered it to her. Find out for yourself.
Beth traced one of the spires with a finger.
The Statue of Liberty, she said.
What?
The Statue of Liberty. That's what this reminds me of. Not the statue itself, but the lady's crown.
She lifted the circle to her head, the spires jutting up.
See? It could be a crown, couldn't it?
I've never seen a lovelier princess, said a man's voice from the darkness beyond the bonfire.
Instantly, Beth had the glass circle protected in her arms and was backing away from the direction of the voice. Sister tensed.
Who's there?
She sensed movement. Someone was walking slowly across the ruins, approaching the firelight's edge. He stepped into the light. His gaze lingered on each of them in turn.
Good evening, he said politely, addressing Sister. He was a tall, broad-shouldered man with a regal bearing, dressed in a dusty black suit. A brown blanket was wrapped around his shoulders and throat like a peasant's serape, and across his pallid, sharp-chinned face were the scarlet streaks of deep burns, like welts inflicted by a whip. A gold-crusted gash zigzagged across the high forehead, cut through his left eyebrow, and ended at his cheekbone. Most of his reddish-gray hair remained, though there were bare spots the size of silver dollars on his scalp. The breath curled from his nose and mouth.
"Is it all right if I come nearer?"
he asked, his voice pained and halting. Sister didn't answer. The man waited.
"I won't bite," he said.
He was shivering, and she couldn't deny him the fire.
"Come ahead,"
she said cautiously, and she stepped back as he did. He winced as he hobbled forward, and Sister saw what was hurting him. A jagged splinter of metal had pierced his right leg just above the knee and stuck out about 3 inches on the other side. He passed between Sister and Beth and went straight to the fire where he warmed his outstretched hands.
"Ah, that feels good. It must be 30 degrees out there."
Sister had felt the cold as well, and she returned to the fire. Behind her, Julia and Beth, who were still protectively clinging to the glass ring, followed.
"Who the hell are you?"
Artie stared bleary-eyed across the bonfire.
"My name is Doyle Halland," the man answered. "Why didn't you people leave with the rest of them?"
"The rest of who?"
Sister asked, still watching him warily.
"The ones who got out. Yesterday, I guess it was, hundreds of them leaving."
He smiled wanly and waved his hand around.
"Leaving the Garden State.
Maybe there are shelters further west, I don't know. Anyway, I didn't expect anyone was left."
"We came from Manhattan," Beth told him. "We made it through the Holland Tunnel."
"I didn't think anybody could have lived through what hit Manhattan. They say it was at least 2 bombs. Jersey City burned fast, and the winds, oh my God, the winds."
He closed his fists before the flames.
"It was a tornado. More than one, I think. The winds just tore buildings off their foundations. I was lucky, I suppose. I got into a basement, but the building blew apart over my head. The wind did this." He gingerly touched the metal splinter. "I've heard of tornadoes putting straws unbroken through telephone poles. I guess this is about the same principle, huh?"
He looked at Sister.
"I realize I'm not at my best. But why are you staring at me like that?"
"Where'd you come from, Mr. Halland?"
"Not far. I saw your fire. If you don't want me to stay, just say so."
Sister was ashamed of what she'd been thinking. He winced again, and she saw that fresh blood had begun to ooze around the splinter.
"I don't own this place. You can stay wherever you please."
"Thank you. It's not a pleasant night to be walking."
His gaze moved to the sparkle of the glass circle Beth was holding.
"That thing shines, doesn't it? What is it?"
"It's..."
She couldn't find the right word.
"It's magic," she blurted out. "You won't believe what just happened. You see that woman over there? She can't speak English, and this thing, it's junk,"
Sister interrupted, taking it from Beth. She didn't trust this stranger yet, and she didn't want him knowing any more about their treasure.
"It's just shiny junk, that's all."
She put it into the bottom of her bag, and the glow of the gems faded and went out.
"You want shiny junk?" the man inquired. "I'll show you some."
He looked around, then hobbled away a few yards and painfully bent down. He picked up something and brought it back to the fire.
"See? It shines just like yours," he said, showing them what he held.
It was a piece of stained glass window, a swirl of deep blue and purple.
"You're standing in what used to be my church," he said.
And he pulled the blanket away from his throat to reveal the soiled white collar of a priest. Smiling bitterly, he tossed the colored glass into the fire. Chapter 23. In the darkness, 16 civilians, men, women, and children, and 3 badly injured members of Colonel Macklin's army struggled to work the tightly jammed puzzle of rocks loose from the lower level corridor. "It's only 6 feet to the food," Macklin had told them. 6 feet. It won't take you long to break through once you get a hole opened. The first one to reach that food gets a triple ration. They had been laboring in total darkness for almost 7 hours when the rest of the ceiling caved in on their heads with no warning. Roland Croninger, on his knees in the cafeteria's kitchen, felt the floor shake. Screams drifted up through an air vent. And then silence. "Damn," he said, because he knew what had happened. Who was going to clear that corridor now? But then, on the other side of the coin, the dead didn't use up air. He went back to his task of scooping up bits of food from the floor and putting them into a plastic garbage bag. He'd suggested that Colonel Macklin set up headquarters in the gymnasium. They'd found a treasure, a mop bucket, in which they could store the toilet bowl water. When Roland, his stomach gnawing with hunger, had left them to forage in the kitchen, both Macklin and Captain Warner had been asleep. Roland had the Ingram gun on a strap around his shoulder, and the handle of the holy axe was secured by his waistband. Near him, the flashlight lay on the floor, illuminating clumps of food that had exploded from cans in the pantry. The kitchen garbage pails had yielded some finds, too. Banana peels, bits of tomato, cans with not all their contents quite scraped out, and a few breakfast biscuits. Anything and everything edible went into Roland's bag, except for the biscuits, which were his first meal since the disaster. He picked up a black piece of something and started to shove it into the bag, but hesitated. The black thing reminded him of what he'd done to Mike Armbruster's pet hamsters, the day Armbruster had brought them to biology class. The hamsters had been left at the back of the room after school while Armbruster went to football practice. Roland had gotten the cage of hamsters without being seen by the cleaning women and had sneaked stealthily to the school's automotive workshop. In one corner stood a metal vat that held a greenish-brown liquid, and over the vat was a red sign that said, "Wear your gloves." Roland had put on a pair of heavy asbestos gloves and made cooing noises to the 2 little hamsters. And he'd thought about Mike Armbruster laughing and spitting on him while he was down in the dust. Then he'd picked up the cage by its handle and lowered it into the vat of acid, which was used to make rusted radiators shine like new. He'd let the hamsters stay under until the bubbles stopped. When he brought the cage up, he noted that the acid had attacked the metal and chewed it down to a polished gleam. Then he took his gloves off and carried the cage back to the biology room on the end of a broom. He'd often wondered what Mike Armbruster's face had looked like when he saw the 2 black things where the hamsters used to be. Armbruster hadn't realized, Roland often mused later, the many ways a king's knight can get even. Roland tossed whatever it was into the bag. He turned up a box of oatmeal and, wonder of wonders, a single green apple. Both of those went into the bag. He continued crawling, lifting the smaller rocks and avoiding the fissures in the floor. He was getting too far from the flashlight and he stood up. The garbage bag had some weight to it now. The king was going to be well pleased. He started toward the light, stepping nimbly over the dead. There was a noise behind him, not a loud noise, just a whirr of disturbed air, and he knew he was no longer alone. Before he could turn, a hand clamped across his mouth. "Get the bag," a man said. "Hurry!" It was torn from his grip. "Little fucker's got an Ingram gun." That too was ripped off his shoulder. The hand moved from his mouth, replaced by an arm at his throat. "Where's Macklin? Where's the son of a bitch hiding?"
I can't breathe," Roland croaked.
The man cursed and flung him to the floor. Roland's glasses flew off, and a boot pressed down on his spine.
"Who you gonna kill with that gun, kid? You gonna make sure you get all the food for yourself and the colonel?"
One of the others retrieved the flashlight and aimed it in Roland's face. He thought there were three of them from the voices and movements, but he couldn't be positive. He flinched as he heard the Ingram gun's safety click off.
"Kill him, Shore," one of the men urged. "Blow his fucking brains out."
Shore. Roland knew that name. Hospitality Sergeant Shore. "I know he's alive, kid." Shore was standing over him, his foot planted on Roland's back. "I went down to the command center and I found those people working in the dark. I found Corporal Prados, too. He told me a kid got Macklin out of a hole and that the colonel was hurt. He just left Prados down there to die, didn't he?"
"The corporal couldn't move. He couldn't stand up because of his leg. We had to leave him."
"Who else is with Macklin?"
"Captain Warner," Roland gasped. "That's all."
"And he sent you here to find food. Did he give you the Ingram gun and tell you to kill everybody else?"
"No, sir."
The wheels of Roland's brain were spinning, trying to find a way to squirm out of this. "Where's he hiding? How many weapons does he have?" Roland was silent. Shore bent down beside him and put the gun's barrel to Roland's temple.
"There are 9 other people not too far from here who need food and water, too," Shore said tersely. "My people. I thought I was going to die, and I've seen things..."
He stopped, shaken, couldn't go on for a moment.
"Things nobody ought to see and live to remember. Macklin's to blame for all of this." He knew this place was falling apart. He must have known it.
The barrel bruised Roland's skull.
High and mighty Macklin with his tin soldiers and his worn-out medals just marching the suckers in and out of here. He knew what was going to happen. Isn't that right?
"Yes, sir."
Roland felt the holy axe pressed against his stomach. Slowly, he began to work his hand under his body.
"He knows there's no way in hell to get to the emergency food, doesn't he? So he sent you here to get the scraps before anybody else could, you little bastard."
Shore grabbed his collar and shook him, which helped Roland slide his hand closer to the holy axe.
"The colonel wants to stockpile everything," Roland said.
"By time," he thought.
"He wants to get everybody together and ration out the food and
"You're a liar! He wants it all for himself."
"No, we can still get through to the emergency food."
"Bullshit!" the man roared, and insanity leapt in his voice. "I heard the rest of Level 1 fall in. I know they're all dead. He wants to kill all of us so he can have the food."
"Finish him, Shore," the other man said. "Shoot his balls off."
"Not yet, not yet. I want to know where Macklin is. Where's he hiding, and how many weapons does he have?"
Roland's fingers were almost touching the blade. "Closer, closer.
He's got a lot of guns. Got a pistol and another machine gun."
"Closer and closer still.
He's got a whole arsenal in there."
"In there? In where?"
"In one of the rooms. It's way down the corridor."
"Almost got it." "What room, you little shit?"
Shore grabbed him again, shook him angrily, and Roland took advantage of the movement. He slid the holy axe out of his waistband and lay on top of it, getting a good strong grip around the handle. When he decided to strike, it would have to be fast, and if the other two men had guns, he was finished.
"Cry," he told himself. He forced a sob.
"Please, please don't hurt me. I can't see without my glasses."
He blubbered and shook.
"Don't hurt me."
He made a retching noise, and he felt the Ingram gun's barrel move away from his skull.
"Little shitter. Little candy-ass shitter. Come on, stand up like a man."
He grasped Roland's arm and started to haul him to his feet.
"Now," Roland thought, very calmly, very deliberately, a king's knight was not afraid of death.
He let the man's strength pull him up, and then he uncoiled like a spring, twisting around and slashing out with the holy axe that still bore some of the king's dried blood on its blade. The flashlight's beam glinted off the cleaver. The blade sliced into Shore's left cheek like it was carving off a piece of Thanksgiving turkey. He was too shocked to react for a second, but then the blood burst out of the wound and his finger jerked involuntarily on the trigger, sending a rattle of bullets whining past Roland's head. Shore staggered backward, half his face peeled open to the bone. Roland rushed him, hacking wildly before the man could aim that gun again. One of the others grabbed Roland's shoulder, but Roland broke away, tearing the rest of his shirt almost off. He swung again at Shore and caught the meaty part of his gun arm. Shore stumbled over a dead body, the Ingram gun clattering to the stones at Roland's feet. Roland scooped it up, his face contorted into a savage rictus, and he whirled upon the man holding the flashlight. He braced his legs in the firing position the colonel had taught him, aimed, and squeezed the trigger. The gun hummed like a sewing machine, but its recoil knocked him back over the rubble and set him on his ass. As he fell, he saw the flashlight explode in the man's hand, and there was a grunt followed by a shrill cry of pain. Someone whimpered and scrabbled away across the floor. Roland fired into the dark, the red trajectories of tracer bullets ricocheting off the walls. There was another scream that broke into gurgling fragments and grew distant. And Roland thought that one of the men must have stepped into a hole in the floor and fallen through. He sprayed the cafeteria with bullets, and then he stopped firing because he knew he was alone again. He listened. His heart was racing. The sweet aroma of a fired weapon hung in the air. "Come on!" he shouted. "You want some more? Come on!" But there was only silence. Whether he'd killed them all or not, he didn't know. He was sure he'd hit at least one. "Bastards," Roland breathed. "You bastards! Next time I'll kill you!" He laughed. It startled him, because it didn't sound like the laughter of anyone he knew. He wished the men would come back. He wanted another chance at killing them. Roland searched for his glasses. He found the garbage bag, but his glasses were lost. Everything would be blurred from now on, but that was okay. There was no more light anyway. His hands found warm blood and a body to go with it. He spent a minute or two kicking the dead man's skull in. Roland picked up the garbage bag and, keeping the Ingram gun ready, carefully moved across the cafeteria toward where he knew the exit to be. His toes probed for holes in the floor, but he made it safely into the corridor. He still trembled with excitement. Everything was black and silent, but for the slow dripping of water somewhere. He felt his way toward the gymnasium with his bag of booty, eager to tell the king that he'd fought off 3 tunnel trolls, and that one of them was named Shore. But there would be more trolls. They wouldn't give up so easily, and besides, he wasn't sure if he'd killed the hospitality sergeant or not. Roland grinned into the darkness, his face and hair damp with cold sweat. He was very, very proud of himself for protecting the king, though he regretted losing the flashlight. In the corridor, he stepped on bodies that were swelling like gas bags. This was turning out to be the greatest game he'd ever played. This beat the computer version by a light year. He'd never shot anybody before. And he'd never felt so powerful before either. Surrounded by darkness and death and carrying a bag full of scraps and a warm Ingram gun, Roland Croninger knew true ecstasy. Chapter 24. A squeaking sound coming from a corner of the basement made Josh reach to his side for the flashlight and switch it on. The weak bulb threw a dim yellow spear of light, but Josh guided it toward that corner to find out what was over there.
"What is it?"
Swan asked, sitting up a few feet behind him.
"I think we've got a rat."
He played the light around, saw only a tangle of timbers, corn stalks, and the mound of dirt where Darlene Prescott lay buried. Josh quickly moved the light away from the grave. The child was just now getting her senses back.
"Yeah, I think it's a rat," Josh decided. probably had a nest hidden down here somewhere. Hey, Mr. Rat, he called. Mind if we share your basement for a while?
He sounds like he's hurt.
He probably thinks we sound pretty bad, too.
He kept the flashlight's beam away from the little girl. He'd already seen her once in the meager light, and that was enough. Almost all of her beautiful blonde hair was burned away, her face a mass of red, watery blisters. Her eyes, which he remembered being so stunningly blue, were deep sunken and a cloudy gray. He was aware that the blast hadn't spared his looks either. The backwash of the light revealed splotched gray burns that covered his hands and arms. More than that, he didn't care to know. He was going to wind up looking like a zebra, but at least they were both still alive, and though he had no way of calculating how much time had passed since the explosion, he thought they'd been down here for maybe 4 or 5 days. Food was no longer a problem, and they had plenty of canned juices. Air must be entering from somewhere, though the basement remained stuffy. The worst concern Josh had was the latrine smell, but that couldn't be helped right now. Maybe later he'd figure out a neater sanitation system, perhaps using the empty cans and burying those in the dirt. Something moved in the light's beam.
Look, Swan said, over there.
A small, burned little animal perched on a tiny hillock of dirt. Its head tilted toward Swan and Josh, and then the animal squeaked again and disappeared into the debris. Josh said,
"That's not a rat.
It's a gopher,"
Swan finished for him.
"I've seen lots of them before, digging out near the trailer park."
"A gopher," Josh repeated.
He remembered Pawpaw's voice saying, "Gophers in the hole." Swan was pleased to see something else alive down here with them. She could hear it sniffing in the dirt over beyond the light and the mound where she let the thought go because she couldn't stand it. But her mama wasn't hurting anymore, and that was a good thing. Swan listened to the gopher snuffling around. She was very familiar with the things because of all the holes they dug in her garden. All the holes they dug, she thought.
Josh,
Swan said.
Yeah.
Gophers dig holes, she said.
Josh smiled faintly at what he took to be just a childlike statement. But then his smile froze as what she was getting at struck him. If a gopher had a nest down here, then there might indeed be a hole leading out. Maybe that was where the air was coming from. Josh's heart leaped. Maybe Pawpaw knew there was a gopher hole somewhere in the basement. And that was the message he'd been trying to relay. A gopher hole could be enlarged to make a tunnel. We've got a pickaxe and shovel, he thought. Maybe we can dig ourselves out. Josh crawled to where the old man lay.
Hey, Josh said. Can you hear me?
He touched Papa's arm.
Oh, Lord, Josh whispered.
The old man's body was cool. It lay stiffly, the arms rigid by the sides. Josh shone the light into the corpse's face, saw the mottled scarlet burns like a strange birthmark across the cheeks and nose. The eye sockets were dark brown gaping holes. Papa had been dead for several hours, at least. Josh started to close Papa's eyelids, but there were none. Those, too, had been incinerated and vaporized. The gopher squeaked. Josh turned away from the corpse and crawled toward the noise, probing into the debris with his light. He found the gopher kicking at its burned hind legs. It abruptly darted under a piece of wood wedged into the corner. Josh reached after it, but the wood was stuck tight. As patiently as he could, he began to work it free. The gopher chattered angrily at the invasion. Slowly, Josh got the splintered piece of timber loose and pulled it away. The light revealed a small round hole in the dirt wall, about 3 inches off the floor.
Found it,
Josh exclaimed. He got down on his belly and shone the light up into the hole. About 2 or 3 feet out of the basement, it crooked to the left and continued on beyond the range of the light. This thing's got to lead to the surface. He was as excited as a kid on Christmas morning, and he was able to get his fist up into the hole. The ground was hard-packed and unyielding, burned even at this depth to the solidity of asphalt. Digging through it was going to be an absolute bitch, but following the hole would make the work easier. One question nagged at him. Did they want to get out of the basement anytime soon? The radiation might kill them outright. God only knew what the surface world would be like. Did they dare find out? Josh heard a noise behind him. It was a hoarse, rattling sound, like congested lungs struggling for air.
Josh?
Swan had heard the noise, too, and it made the remaining hairs on the back of her neck stand up. She had sensed something moving in the darkness just a few seconds before. He turned and shone the light at her. Swan's blistered face was turned to the right. Again, there came that hideous, rattling noise. Josh shifted the light, and what he saw made him feel as if a freezing hand had clenched his throat. Papa's corpse was shivering, and that awful noise was emanating from it. He's still alive, Josh thought incredulously. But then, no. He was dead when I touched him. He was dead. The corpse lurched, slowly, arms still stiff at its sides. The dead man began to sit up. Its head started turning, inch by inch, like a clockwork automaton, toward Josh Hutchins. Its raw eye sockets seeking the light. The burned face rippled, the mouth straining to open, and Josh thought that if those dead lips parted, he would lose whatever marbles he had left right then and there. With a hiss and rattle of air, the mouth opened, and from it came a voice like the rush of wind through dried-up reeds. It was at first an unintelligible sound, thin and distant, but it was getting stronger, and it said,
"Bro, Dad."
The eye sockets faced the beam of light as if there were still eyeballs in them.
"Protect,"
the awful voice repeated. The mouth with its gray lips seemed to be straining to form words. Josh shrank backward, and the corpse ratcheted out,
"Protect the child."
There was a quiet whoosh of air. The corpse's eye sockets caught fire. Josh was mesmerized, and he heard Swan give a soft, stunned,
"Oh."
The corpse's head burst into a fireball, and the fire spread and enveloped the entire body in a writhing reddish-blue cocoon. An intense wave of heat licked at Josh's face, and he put up his hand to shield his eyes. When he lowered it again, he saw the corpse dissolving at the center of its fiery shroud. The body remained sitting upright, motionless now, every inch of it ablaze. The burning went on for maybe 30 seconds longer, and the fire began to flicker out, and the last to burn were the soles of Papa's shoes. But what lingered was white ash in the shape of a man sitting upright. The fire went out. The ashen shape crumbled. It was ash through and through, even the bones. It collapsed in a heap on the floor, and what remained of Papa Briggs was ready for a shovel. Josh stared. Ash drifted lazily through the light. "I'm going off my bird," he thought. "All those body slams have caught up with me." Behind him, Swan bit her lower lip and fought off frightened tears. "I won't cry," she told herself. "Not any more." The urge to sob passed, and she let her shocked eyes drift toward the black giant. Protect the child. Josh had heard it. But Papa Briggs had been dead, he reasoned. Protect the child. Sue Wanda. Swan. Whatever had spoken through the dead man's lips was gone now. It was just Josh and Swan alone. He believed in miracles, but of the biblical version. The parting of the Red Sea, the turning of water to wine, the feeding of the multitude from a basket of bread and fish. Up until this moment, he'd thought the age of miracles was long past. But maybe